If you would join me in Daniel chapter 11, I'm going to pick up just where we left off last week's study. We are engaged in a study through one of the two most challenging portions in the study through the book of Daniel. The other most challenging portion, identified as the most challenging, was back when we were studying through the 70 weeks of years prophecy. That was the most challenging because it was the most spiritually complex of all of the prophecies. This prophecy that we're engaged in right now is complex in its own way, but less spiritually complex, more historically complex, meaning there's just so much historical detail involved with this prophecy that Daniel is given here in chapter 11 that it challenges us, especially those of us. I mean, I consider myself to be somewhat of an amateur history buff, meaning I like to read history even apart from Bible history. I just enjoy history. It's an interesting subject to me, always was. And I'm even more interested in Bible history. But even this section has been somewhat difficult and challenging, stretching, but it's been good for me. And I knew it would be challenging for you as well. I hope you're surviving or taking the time to do the extra work of slowing down and really engaging in all of the details of this passage. What we're doing is we're studying this final prophecy of Daniel. Remember, there's a series of five prophetic words that the Lord gives to Daniel through a variety of dreams and visions and direct words. This last one being a direct message from the Lord himself. It's the longest of all five of the prophecies. It stretches really over the last three chapters of the book, chapters 10, 11, and 12. All of our study through chapter 10 was, in a sense, the introduction to what we're studying now. It's the account of how the Lord appeared to Daniel and why he chose to appear to him in the manner that he did to kind of introduce this final prophecy. And then we're right now engaged in going through the verses, you know, the details of chapter 11, which is the actual substance of the prophecy. The entire chapter 11 is covering this, what we've identified as the intertestamental period. This is the some 400 years between the final prophet of the Old Testament, Malachi, and the one who is both the final prophet of the Old Testament and the first prophet of the New Testament, John the Baptist. In that 400-year period between Malachi and John, the Lord had ceased speaking new words to his people. And they were dependent, if they were to hear from God, on looking back and paying extra close attention to what God had already previously spoken through other prophets, through the words that were written down in Scripture for them. And this prophecy, this final prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, is one of those most important passages that they needed to pay attention to, because this prophecy addresses the events of this intertestamental period. We've also seen, and we actually first gained this understanding back in our study through the 70 weeks prophecy in chapter 9, but this period is also referred to as a troubled time, or a time of troubled. We've identified that while you can certainly identify any era of history as a time filled with trouble, because the world we live in is a fallen world, this is a heightened time of trouble, and a greater degree of trouble than just normal, average, everyday trouble that goes on in the world. And it's not just general trouble in the world, as sadly many well-intentioned Bible teachers read passages like we're about to study tonight and see this as just describing general trouble going on in the world during a special time in history. This is a troubled time for God's holy nation, his covenant people. And it's not undeserved trouble. It's not accidental trouble. It's not trouble that just happened to find its way to their front doorstep. This is well-deserved and sadly earned trouble. This is trouble because they have, for generations, stretching all the way back to Moses. They have broken God's law. Remember, as we've studied many times, they broke it before Moses even could finish coming down from the mountain with the revelation of the law. They were already breaking it at the foot of the mountain as he was receiving it. And they, with some few shining contrary times, for the most part, for all the generations between Moses and Daniel, they have consistently broken God's law and broken it in tremendous ways, tremendously bad ways. And the circumstance that Daniel finds himself in is the testimony to that, which is, Daniel, remember, this is the backdrop of our study of the prophecy. Daniel is in Persia right now. He's in Persia. Previously, he was in Babylon. And he's in those locations because he is part of the dispersion of God's people due to their captivity. And their captivity is because of their rebellion. This is the Lord's judgment upon his nation. But as bad as the judgment has been up until this time, this prophecy highlights and warns of a coming even greater trouble, a more focused and heightened trouble, a short burst of time. The entire time period is going to be a troubled time, but toward the tail end of this time period, there's going to be a significant outpouring of trouble, persecution, and difficulty that is going to nearly overwhelm the people of God. And so as we studied at the end of our section last week, the Lord is gracious to reveal to his people before it ever happens what is going to happen, when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and through whom it's going to happen. So that when it does happen, their hearts, those who have ears to hear and eyes to see, those who are following the Lord and paying attention to his word, they would be equipped, they would be prepared, they would be solid in their hearts and anchored in their trust to the Lord in spite of the deeply troubling circumstances that they have to pass through. All right, so in chapter 11, we've studied two sections so far. We're going to start our third section tonight. The first section was verses 1 through 4. This is just a rehearsal of from the day that Daniel is receiving this prophecy forward, there's going to be a series of four Persian kings leading up to Xerxes, who is also called Ahasuerus, who is the same king we see in the book of Esther. Then in verses 5 through 20, which is what our study was last time, we have the almost exhausting to us details of the series of the kingships that succeed one another. These are from the divided Greek Empire. The Greeks, as it's described earlier in the prophecy, the Greeks are going to overwhelm the Persians that are currently ruling the world. They're going to conquer the Persians under Alexander the Great. But Alexander, at the height of his power and at the height of his conquest, is going to suddenly and unexpectedly die of a mysterious disease. And when he dies, his great world-dominated empire is going to be divided into four sections. Those four sections are going to follow the compass points, north, south, east, and west. All four of those play their own role in the story. But two of those four sections, and this is what we saw in verses 5 through 20, two of those sections are going to be highlighted. Two kingdoms. Those are the North Kingdom and the South Kingdom. The North Kingdom is called the Seleucid Empire, or the Seleucid Kingdom. It's also known as the Syrian Kingdom. It's in the region of the world centered around modern-day Syria in the Middle East. The South Kingdom is the Ptolemaic, starting with a P. The Ptolemaic Empire, which is in Egypt, centered in Egypt and specifically the capital city of Alexandria, which was established by Alexander the Great in his own honor. So verses 5 through 20 follow several hundred years of history, the tug of war that's taking place after Alexander dies between two of the four sections into which his great empire was divided, and those two sections, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, are constantly at war with each other, trying, like I use the image of two dogs tugging on one bone, trying to gain mastery over this area of the world. And at times in these verses, the southern kingdom takes ascendance. And at the beginning of this time period, the Ptolemies and Egypt were winning that tug of war. But then eventually the Seleucids, the Syrians, the northern kingdom, overwhelm the southern kingdom, and they gain the upper hand. All right, so that's where we left off in our study. Now we're starting verses 21 through 35 tonight. And I identified that verse 21 takes a shift in focus. It's not nearly so broad and covering so much of world history. Now it's going to cover a very focused and specific period of history, which is 175 B.C. to 163 B.C. And its focus still is dealing with this tug of war between the northern and southern kingdoms, but the focus is primarily on the king of the northern kingdom at this time period, between 175 and 163, and his name is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. We've encountered this character before. He's a very significant character in Bible prophecy. You don't hear about him as much in modern day studies as you should, but he certainly is the focal point of this section that we're about to engage in. Now, the reason why you don't hear about him as much anymore is that we've been doing a kind of comparative study all the way through this prophetic portion of the book of Daniel since we shifted gears in our study in chapter 7 and beyond into the prophetic section of Daniel. And our comparative study has been between two schools of prophetic teaching in modern Christianity, today's Christian Bible study. Those two schools are dispensationalism. We've talked about this before, but I'm just reminding everybody. And the view, which this dispensational view I disagree with, and I've been, in a sense, kind of comparing and arguing with theologically throughout these chapters. And the second view is the view that I hold. I didn't come up with this view. I didn't invent this view, but I do agree with it. And I believe it's the biblical way to understand this passage, the right way to understand it. And that is the covenantal historical view. Now, the main difference, and there's a lot of details that go into explaining why these two schools of thought have formed around different ways to interpret Bible prophecy. But the main difference between these two is that the dispensational view views these events as taking place yet in our future. It's called a futurist approach. The covenantal view, on the other hand, is a historical approach, meaning it believes that these events are describing these prophecies, not all prophecies in the Bible, but these prophecies that we're studying in the book of Daniel are dealing with events that have already been fulfilled and have already occurred. They are not in our future, because this view holds that all of these events are leading to the first coming of Christ, not the second coming. But the dispensational view takes this section, and I'm talking about the original historical dispensational view, the one that started in the mid-1800s, the one that you can still find in most commentaries that are coming from this school, even in the Bible bookstores today. They view that this section that we're about to study is in our future and does not relate to Antiochus Epiphanes, but relates to a future Antichrist. Now, I'm not going to, as I've done in some of the other sections, go through and compare why in each detail it can't be a future fulfillment. The reason for that is because if it is yet a future fulfillment, you can make any possible future event fit the description. because it hasn't happened yet. What I am going to show you is why I am convinced personally that these verses, Daniel 11, 21 through 35, have already occurred. They've already happened. They've already been fulfilled. And they too perfectly describe the events that the covenant people of God actually lived through during this intertestamental time of great trouble. All right? So, let's dig in to this description. I said we've encountered this individual before, Antiochus Epiphanes. We're going to read verses 21 through 35, but before we do, let's go back and refresh ourselves briefly on where we first encountered this guy. He was first introduced to us prophetically by Daniel, actually by the Lord through Daniel, in a prior prophecy, and this is back in chapter 8. We studied through this in detail, and we will read it again. I'm not going to go into all the details. Again, those tapes, those CDs are available for you to listen to, or they're downloaded on or available on our Sermon Audio webpage. Feel free to get those and re-listen to them. But let me read to you the two sections that are addressing the same exact events that we're about to study tonight. So you might say, well, wait a second. If the Lord has already given Daniel a prophecy of these events, why would he come back later and with a new prophecy, a new revelation, give him more of the same? Well, that's the way the Lord is. He oftentimes teaches us layer upon layer and, in a sense, giving us a first glimpse to understand what's about to come and then coming back later, revisiting that same subject. And what he usually does is building on the understanding gained from the first, he will add more details to it in the second event or the second vision, the second revelation. And that's what's going to happen. We'll see that the section we're about to read in chapter 8 has significant details describing Antiochus Epiphanes, his career, how he influenced and affected God's covenant people, the Jews, and Jerusalem and the temple. But then in chapter 11, in the section we're about to study, we'll see that there's even more details given, and we'll go into those details in some depth tonight. So back in chapter 8, there's two sections in chapter 8 that address the events connected to Antiochus Epiphanes. Those are chapter 8, verses 9 through 14, and then chapter 8, verses 19 through 25. So I'm just going to read those two sections to catch us up to what we've, to kind of just refamiliarize you with what we've already studied in some depth. Daniel chapter 8, verse 9. Out of one of them came, and that's out of the four conspicuous horns. These are the four sections of the divided Greek Empire. That's what these four horns are pointed to in verse 8. Out of one of them came a little horn. This little horn is Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, that's toward Egypt, and toward the east, and toward the glorious land. The glorious land, remember, is the Holy Land, God's covenant nation's land, the promised land. In verse 10, it grew great, even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. I went into detail about what those stars are. They're leaders of the Jewish people at that particular time in history. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of the sanctuary was overthrown. We saw back then the horrors that Antiochus Epiphanes enacted in Jerusalem and upon the temple and the ways that he profaned the temple. We'll go back in, we'll double back and see some more details about that tonight. In the place of his, he became great, even as great as the prince of the host. The regular burnt offering was taken away from him, the place of his sanctuary overthrown. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. We saw there that that was referring to that there would be a host of the Jewish people that would die in this circumstance when Antiochus invaded Jerusalem. and they would die because of their sins, because of their long-standing rebellion against the Lord. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. The little horn threw truth to the ground in that he denied the truth of the Bible and even outlawed the scriptures at that period of time. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." We saw that this amount of time exactly fit, and you'll have to get the CD because I go into great detail about that, but it exactly fit the period of time that Antiochus was doing this. Now let's skip down to verse 19 of chapter 8. He said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation." This indignation is this particular period of persecution and this judgment that's being poured out upon God's covenant people. "For it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king," that's Alexander the Great. "As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressions have reached their limit, a king of bold face," that's Antiochus Epiphanes, "one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great." Remember, he named himself Epiphanes, which meant that he titled himself, "I am God manifest." "And without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand." He did die at the end of this period of persecution, but again, he died mysteriously, unexpectedly, and he died by no man's hand, did not die in battle. All right, so that's just to quickly refresh you of what we've already covered. Now let's move to chapter 11, and dig into the prophecy that's ahead of us. We're going to read, and I'm not going to stop for details. Excuse me. I'm going to just read verses 21 through 35, and then we'll go back through and I'll give you a brief description of each verse and each detail in each verse so that you can tag the actual events of history with the prophecy. So reading from Daniel 11, 21. "In his place shall rise a contemptible person." This contemptible person, and I said I'd save the details, but this is now Antiochus Epiphanes. "In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with the small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his fathers' fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a little time, and he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail. For the end is yet to be at the appointed time. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before, for ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white till the time of the end. For it still awaits the appointed time. Now, I will just say before we dig into the details again, this section, like all of God's Word, as challenging as it may be for us, because none of us are experts in ancient world history or this particular era of world history, so it is inherently challenging for us and somewhat difficult and requires extra attention and you know, just it strains our attention span. Nevertheless, God intends for us to understand this. There's nothing in God's Word that He's written down for us that He's just dangling out there as a, you know, carrot on a stick. You know the story of the carrot on the stick with a horse or a donkey? Why do they put a carrot on a stick? It's to motivate the donkey or the horse to move forward, but there's no hope that the donkey or the horse can ever get to the carrot. It's a tease to just motivate falsely the animal to work. You know, move forward, you know, thinking, the animal's thinking, I'm going to get the carrot, I'm going to get the carrot, I'm going to get the carrot, but it can never reach it because it's suspended on a stick, you know, tied to his back. And God's Word is not like that for us. God doesn't tease us with passages like this. He wants us to get it. All Scripture is inspired by God. It's profitable to teach us and to convict us and to correct us and to train us. But if we don't understand what it's saying or what it applies to as it was originally revealed, then how can we possibly understand how it's supposed to instruct me, convict me, correct me, and train me today for my life and my future and my mission as part of God's church in this generation? So I think it's critically important for us to get it, and I know that I'm confident the Lord wants us to get it, and there's no reason that we shouldn't get it. So let's go through this section, verse by verse, and fill in the detail gaps. Verse 21. I'll reread each verse individually and give you some historical detail to connect to the fulfillment of the prophetic description. In his place shall arise a contemptible person. In his place is simply the previous king in verse 20 of the Seleucid Empire. So in the place of the previous king shall arise a contemptible person. Antiochus is introduced to us in this prophecy. This is God's evaluation. Think of that for just a moment. God looks at this man and he identifies him as a contemptible person. You know, we have kind of in modern Christianity, anyway, there were earlier, bolder, sterner, hardier versions of Christianity in previous generations. In much of modern Christianity, there's kind of like a bland version of God. You know, he just loves everybody the same, feels exactly the same about everybody, no matter how they live, what they do, choices they make, values they either exalt or trample on. God feels the same toward them and treats them the same. It's just not the biblical portrayal of who the Lord is. The Lord viewed Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, as a contemptible person. Anyone want to give me some help dictionary-wise? What does the word contemptible mean? It's a really, really bad person. There's no redeeming value in this person. He's bad. He's bad to the bone. And that's certainly the case with this man. One of the worst men in history, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Not the worst, but one of the worst. You know, if we were to create a top 10 list, he might fit up there. You know, he might slot in the worst men in history. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. Antiochus was not a royally authorized heir and designated heir to the throne of the Seleucid kingdom in the north. He was not part of the royal line. He was related to the royal family, but the next king that was slated to take the rule in the Seleucid kingdom was his brother. Being the contemptible man that he wasn't satisfied with his brother having the rule. And so what happened was, his brother for a period of time was captured by the Romans in a tug of war with the Roman Empire, the budding early development of the Roman Empire. And while his brother was captured, it's kind of like if you're familiar with the Robin Hood story. The Robin Hood story is based around the idea that that King Richard the Lionheart has gone off to fight in the Crusades in Palestine. And on his way back to England, he's been captured and held prisoner in France. And his wicked brother, Prince John, uses that as an opportunity to take the royal position from his brother and conspires to leave his brother Richard in prison and to, you know, kind of gain the throne. That's exactly what happened here with Antiochus. His brother was captured by the Romans. He saw it as a great opportunity to become king. And so he gathered a few trusted advisors to conspire with him. And he took the throne of Syria, of the Seleucid kingdom, and essentially stranded his brother in that circumstance. So in his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given, meaning he is the king, but he didn't legally belong as the king. Next detail. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now, the word flatteries here just means whisperings behind the scenes, what we call the kind of smoke-filled rooms in high-level politics where very powerful individuals get in a room together and they make plans and plots and they plot the destiny of kingdoms and countries that they rule over. And that's exactly what happened here. This is referring to this conspiracy that he hatched to steal the kingdom from his brother. Verse 22, it says, armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. Now, this is referring to the beginning of the version of Antiochus of his desire. And this isn't a new desire with him. This is an old desire going all the way back through our last study, verses 5 through 20, of the long-standing tug-of-war between the northern kingdom of the Seleucids and the southern kingdom of the Ptolemies in Egypt, his desire to gain power over Egypt, over the southern kingdom. And so the armies that are going to be swept away before Antiochus are the armies of Egypt that stand in opposition to him. And they really were at this time in history because there was no tug of war going on with the western portion of the four divided Greek empires and the eastern portion. They had really faded in prominence. The battle now, the tug of war, is really between the north and the south at this time in history. So armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. This phrase causes some confusion for students. because of the key word covenant. Usually, when we see the word covenant in the Bible, we tend to immediately think of a spiritual context, a spiritual agreement. Like we refer to the old covenant and the new covenant that replaced it. Jesus formed for us a new covenant, replacing the old covenant that was formed through Abraham and confirmed later and established with more detail through Moses. Now, it is possible that the covenant that's referred to here has that kind of a spiritual connotation, but it doesn't necessarily, and it doesn't have to have that kind of spiritual connotation, because God's people weren't the only one in the ancient world that formed covenant arrangements or covenant agreements. Here, this covenant, I believe, is not a spiritual covenant, but it is a political covenant. And I'll explain that in just a moment. There was, between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, this ongoing, more than a couple of hundred years now, of battling back and forth, tugging back and forth for supremacy between these two kingdoms. But as we saw in our study last week, there were interludes between their battles in which they stopped, formed truces, formed even alliances with each other, and in a couple of cases even had arranged marriages. Like, for instance, the king of the north sending his daughter, and we'll encounter her in a little bit here, I mentioned her last week, Cleopatra, who was the daughter of one of the northern Seleucid kings, but was sent to marry the king of the south, forming an alliance between the kingdoms for a period of time, a truce time. Whenever those alliances were formed, they were referred to or called covenants. So this, I believe, is describing a covenant arrangement between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And the circumstance absolutely has to do with Cleopatra at this moment in history, because at this moment in history, Antiochus Epiphanes IV is the brother of Cleopatra. And she has been sent to the southern kingdom to form a covenant truce by marrying the king of the southern kingdom, who is Antiochus's nephew. Now, you don't have to remember these details. It gets somewhat, in the ancient world, you know, if you've ever read any of these, you know, ebbs and flows of ancient kingdoms, like if you study just the history of European monarchies, the royal family lines in Europe between Spain and France and England, for instance, you'll see that they would typically intermarry. And you might have someone who starts as a princess in Spain and she ends up being the queen of France because of intermarriage and these kind of political alliances. All right, so I believe the Prince of the Covenant is the king of the south at this moment in time, who is Ptolemy. He's one of the Ptolemies, and he's the ruler in Egypt, and the capital city is Alexandria. All right, so what does it say about him? Army shall be utterly swept away before Antiochus and broken. Even the Prince of the Covenant is going to be broken by Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay? Let's go on to the next verse, verse 23. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, that's this alliance we were just describing, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. This is what Antiochus is doing. Antiochus makes a political arrangement with the king of the south, forming a truce, forming an alliance with the kingdom of the south, but his purpose in doing so was not to be friends, but to just put the king of the south off guard, to get him to lower his guard against Antiochus so that he could come in under the guise of, I am your ally. I am your friend. Why would the King of the South value an ally? Because Rome was rising to power at this particular moment in history. And Cleopatra herself is later going to be involved in Rome. If you've ever watched the old Hollywood version of Cleopatra with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, it's a Hollywood version of history, but it portrays the events going on soon after these events that we're studying here, where the Romans actually come into Alexandria with an intention of taking over through the first great Julius Caesar. All right, so what's happening here is Antiochus makes this alliance, pretending to be the friend of the king of the south, Ptolemy. And instead, he is planning all along to stab Ptolemy in the back first opportunity he gets. And so he brings a small force with him, kind of like a personal guard with him into Egypt, under the guise of, I am here to support you, Ptolemy. I'm going to give you advice. I'm going to give you military strategy so that you can defend yourself against the Romans. And as he enters into Egypt, what he does is he secretly, without Ptolemy realizing it, takes over every one of the fortresses in Egypt under the guise that I'm going to set these fortresses in order for you. I'm going to train them. I'm going to teach them how to resist the Romans. But what he was really doing was taking over. And he took over every fortress in Egypt except for one, which was the capital city of Alexandria. All right, let's read on. So from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with small people. In other words, an army so small that there's no way he could take over, yet because of his deceit, he was able to do it with his small force. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, that's the richest parts of Egypt, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done. What was it that his fathers and father's fathers had never been able to do? For over a couple hundred years now, these northern and southern kingdoms have been tugging on this bone of who's going to be the dominant force in this part of the world. And his fathers could never conquer the Egyptian kings. But he now does it through deceit rather than through force of might. And he accomplishes what all the previous Antiochian and Seleucid kings were not able to do ever since the days of Alexander the Great, and that's to conquer Egypt. And so he scatters among them plunder, spoil, and goods, and he shall devise plans against strongholds. These are the fortresses that he took over secretly, privately, or under the guise of training them. The strongholds are the fortresses, but only for a time. What this means simply is that he did conquer each one of the strongholds of Egypt except for Alexandria. And as soon as he did, and as soon as he basically had power over Egypt, he suddenly had in his mind, I need to return back to my homeland of Syria. I need to return to my capital city. He had heard rumors that there was problems in his own capital. And so he left those fortresses and he returned to the northern kingdom, to Syria. Verse 25. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Okay, so Antiochus has secretly, deceitfully, under the guise of being the ally of Ptolemy, the king of the south, king of Egypt, he's gone in and taken over all the fortresses of Egypt, but he has to leave to go back home to Syria. And understand, it's not like you can just catch a red-eye flight and you're back in Syria. It's a long journey back to Syria. While he's gone, Ptolemy realizes what's happened. I've lost my empire. I've lost my own fortresses. And so he goes to work to regain control of his fortresses. Now, Antiochus, back in the Syrian capital, gets word that he's losing the control of Egypt that he's just gained by deceit. And now, because he still controls some of those fortresses, he decides, I'm going to come in with force now. I'm not going to come in through deceit, because my deceit won't work again. I've already shown my true colors. This time I have to come with an army. And so he raises a huge northern army, marches into Egypt. They do battle at a specific location. It's a very famous battle in history. It's the Battle of Pelusium. If you wanted to look it up, you know, in the encyclopedia for some, or Google it for some background information. Let me get that name on the board. Pelusium. This is where Antiochus, the king of Syria, the king of the Seleucids, the king of the north, brings a huge army in to wage war with Ptolemy, the king of the south, the king of Egypt. This is described for us in verse 25. He shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army. This is the largest army that Ptolemy had ever assembled to try to fight off the threat of Antiochus. But he shall not stand. He who? Ptolemy, king of the south, shall not stand. Why? Because plots shall be devised against him. Ptolemy had two very trusted advisors who royally mismanaged his affairs and his strategies and his army and undermined his effort to defend himself against Antiochus. And he was completely defeated at the Battle of Pelusium. Verse 26, even those who eat his food shall break him. This is referring to these close, trusted royal advisors within his own palace. His army shall be swept away. That's the king of the south. The Egyptian army is swept away. And many shall fall down slain. Now, it is interesting that it says many shall fall down slain. It was very common in the ancient world. We even have biblical stories of great battles in which every individual on the losing side was put to death and, you know, utterly slain. And that was very common because it was a way to consolidate power in the ancient world. And the ancient world was a pretty brutal place in terms of the field of battle and the field of war. But what Antiochus chose to do was once he saw that he had won the strategic battle, won the actual Battle of Pelusium, he ordered all of his forces to have mercy on the remaining forces of the Egyptians, and he did so in order to, in a sense, consolidate his power because he didn't want to leave Egypt without defense against the Romans. So he kind of like incorporated them into his own army at that point. So many will fall down slain, but he left many alive as well. Verse 27. And as for the two kings, which two kings? King of the north, Antiochus, king of the south, Ptolemy. As for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the appointed time. Ptolemy lost this battle, but Ptolemy was Antiochus' nephew. You know, so it was very common in those days. You've lost the battle, but, you know, you're still welcome at my table. We'll sit down and have a meal together. And they formed an alliance after the battle was settled. Ptolemy was now recognizing, I can't win. Antiochus is the superior power. I might as well get with the program and acknowledge him as my king, but I will be his next in command. And it's exactly what happened. Ptolemy was appointed to be king over Egypt by Antiochus, representing the authority of Antiochus. But they hated each other, and they didn't trust each other. And even though they're sitting at the same table and eating food and planning and plotting things together against the Romans, they're still secretly planning and plotting against each other. Antiochus is using Ptolemy, and Ptolemy is trying to figure out how he can stab his uncle in the back, just like his uncle had previously stabbed him in the back. It's one big happy family. So they shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. Meaning that you would think this battle would have resolved everything. It's not the end of everything, because God has still more plans for both of these kings to continue in their pursuit of their own purposes. Verse 28, and he shall return to his land with great wealth. He who? This is now Antiochus, because Ptolemy's already in his own land. The battle took place in Egypt. He remains there as the newly appointed king of Egypt on behalf of Antiochus, and Antiochus returns to his own land. He returns to the north once again. Now, though, he's rich. He was rich before, but he's really rich now, because he has just ransacked the treasuries of Egypt to finance his wars of expansion. So he shall return to his own land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant. Now, what happened was, on his way back north, he just had the bright idea to stop in Jerusalem and to lay waste to Jerusalem. He just didn't like the people that lived in Jerusalem. He had issues with them. They were stubborn. They were hard-hearted in his perspective. They were more resistant to his plans and purposes than any other people in the region. He decided, now that I'm at the height of my power and I've got my greatest riches at my disposal, I'm going to teach them a lesson, just to prove the point to everyone that Egypt can't resist me, Palestine can't resist me, I am in charge in this region of the world. So he stops in Jerusalem, and he attacks Jerusalem, and he kills 80,000 Jews. Not in battle so much. He just marches in with his army and starts killing civilians, 80,000 of them, to prove a point. Another 80,000 he enslaved. 40,000 he made prisoner, and another 40 he sold off into slavery to finance this particular battle. And he proceeded to, once he conquered the city of Jerusalem, he proceeded to defile the temple. He really did not like the Jewish worship, because he was dedicated to the Greek god, as we've studied before, Zeus, the king of the Greek gods on Mount Olympus, in their view of the spiritual realm. And he personally identified with Zeus, even so much so, remember I told you there he had a certain statue in Zeus's honor that was erected, that just happened to have his own face on the statue, you know, portraying himself as I am equal to the great god Zeus, or I am Zeus's representative in this world. So what he did once he conquered Jerusalem is he marched into the temple precincts, which were, of course, holy ground, and no Gentile was allowed to enter. You know, there was the court of the Gentiles. They were allowed to approach to a certain, you know, degree of proximity to the temple, but not allowed to go any further. And the Levitical priests were intended to be gatekeepers and to keep any Gentiles from entering the temple proper. But they were overwhelmed by the armies of Antiochus. So he marched in, took over the temple. And when he did, he had a pig sacrificed on the altar directly outside of the front door of the temple. He chose a pig to be sacrificed because he knew that that would be the greatest offense to the Jews and to the Jewish priesthood. And then when the pig was sacrificed, he had the carcass of the pig that was sacrificed cooked in a giant kettle into a broth, you know, like pig soup. And he took the broth and he had his soldiers take the broth and sprinkle it throughout all the temple precincts, meaning through the structure of the temple, like going around the internal structure of the temple and making sure the entire temple and every article of furniture within the temple was sprinkled with pig broth. Well, what would he be doing there? It's like a dog marking its territory, saying, I am the top dog here. I'm in charge. My God is greater than your God. And this is the proof. All right? And he shall work his will, at the end of verse 28, return to his own land. That's after he accomplished the sacking of Jerusalem and the defiling of the temple. He said, okay, that's enough. I proved my point. I'm heading back to my capital city in Syria, which was to the north of Jerusalem. Verse 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south. Now, this is very important phrasing right here at this point in the story. At the time appointed, he shall return. What does at the time appointed imply? It implies that he thinks this is not an appointment he made. This isn't on his calendar. This isn't Antiochus deciding, well, I've done my duty, now I'm going back to Syria, and then at the appointed time I've made an appointment, I'm going to return again to the south. The idea here is that he thinks he's just doing what he wants to do, but God is appointing all of this for him, even the evil that he's doing, because it's serving a greater, deeper, and more mysterious purpose in the plans of God. Even the sacking of the temple, the defiling of the temple, was serving the purpose of God, because it's part of the judgment poured out upon God's holy covenant people. But the point of mentioning it at the time appointed here is to just, for those who have ears to hear and eyes to see, it seems at this moment like, certainly, you know, where's Yahweh? Yahweh's deserted us. I mean, this guy has just honored Zeus in the house of the Lord, and he's just, you know, poured pig broth on everything. You know, God has deserted us. And this phrasing describes for us that, no, God is absolutely in charge. He's still appointing all of these things. So in verse 29, then, at the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south. But it shall not be this time as it was before. So he's gone now to the north. And again, Ptolemy, who is now his ally, his vice regent, his underling, Ptolemy has been conspiring the whole time that he's been, Antiochus has been gone, to try to regain his own kingdom in Egypt. And he has retaken many of the fortress cities, and now he is preparing to do battle against Antiochus. So Antiochus says, all right, that's it. I am done with this Ptolemy. I am going to teach him a lesson once for all. So he assembles an army again, and he comes to Egypt to invade it. And this time, before, he had conquered all the fortresses surrounding Alexandria, but never conquered Alexandria, the capital city. This time, he gets 4 miles away from Alexandria, and he is ready to finish the conquest of Egypt. And something unexpected happens. That's going to be described for us in a moment in verse 30. But the introduction is, it shall not be as it was before. As it was before was he won a total victory in his first invasion of Egypt. Now he's invading Egypt a second time. He's stronger than he was before, but he's not going to gain the same victory that he did in his first invasion. And that's because in verse 30, ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. All right, what happens is he gets 4 miles away from Alexandria, and the Romans have caught wind of what's going on in this battle between the northern and southern kingdoms, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And the Romans have their own interests now in Egypt, because Egypt was a very rich land. And the Roman Empire is growing. It's becoming stronger and stronger. It's not yet a world-dominating force. It will be soon, but it's not yet a world-dominating force. But it's strong enough that Antiochus has reason not to want to fight them. He doesn't want to have to fight on two fronts, both against Egypt and against Rome. And so he is stopped 4 miles from Alexandria by an ambassador sent from Rome, by the Roman emperor, by the man who's basically the prime leader in Rome at that time. There's not technically an emperor yet at this point in history. But this ambassador comes to him, and he comes to him sailing on Greek-made ships from the region of Cyprus, which is referred to biblically using Hebraic descriptions as Kittim. And that actually happened in history, that we have the Roman ambassador who sails in with a navy of Kittim-made ships, but it's a Roman fleet. And he confronts Antiochus just on the verge of conquering Alexandria. And he says to him, if the Roman Senate has told me to tell you, if you pursue your conquest of Alexandria, Rome will declare war against you next. So we are ordering you to stop here and to turn back and to leave Egypt alone. And the ambassador went so far as, it was a very dramatic confrontation, they were in a public square as this negotiation was taking place, and the ambassador took a stick and drew a circle directly around Antiochus. And he said, if you leave this circle before you give me your answer, we will still declare war against you. So the only answer that we're going to accept is that you're willing to leave this region and go back to where you belong. And Antiochus, because he wasn't prepared to fight Rome along with Egypt, you know, he humbly, but not in his heart, he humbly submitted to Rome's demands, and he withdrew his forces from Alexandria and did not attack Alexandria. And he started his march back to Syria, back to the north, but he's grumbling all the way back because he's frustrated, he's angry, his pride is wounded, and he's got to make a point to the world that's watching that I am not some dog that you can just kick and, you know, I'll go scurrying off with my tail between my legs. So he decides, I know, I will take out my anger and I will make a point of the Jews like I did before. This is where we see verse 30, for ships of Kittim shall come against him and he shall be afraid, not of the Egyptians that he's fighting, but of the Romans who are threatening. He shall be afraid and withdraw and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. This is against God's covenant people. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. What he did was he marched this time into Jerusalem, and he had a different strategy than his first invasion. This is the second of three invasions of Antiochus against Jerusalem. And in this case, what he did was he gave an opportunity to the leaders of Jerusalem to basically submit to him and to submit to his demands. And his primary demand was this. We've studied this before. His primary demand was this principle called Hellenization. Hellenization is the Greekifying of the world. It was an enforced acceptance of Greek language, Greek culture, and Greek worship. And he marched into Jerusalem and he met with the leaders in Jerusalem and he said, if you will accept my demands and essentially become Greeks, then I will embrace you and I will be good to you. And I will give you many gifts and blessings. But if you resist and you insist on your Jewish ways and your Jewish worship and your Jewish language and all of those things that are contrary to my plan to dominate this region of the world, then I'm going to come with a heavy hand against you. Sadly, the high priest at that time, a man named Menelaus, was a Hellenist. He had embraced Greek culture, Greek language, Greek ways, and his philosophy was, it doesn't matter what god we worship, as long as we're just orderly in our worship. And he was the high priest of the temple. And so what he did was he essentially became Antiochus' right-hand man in this effort to Hellenize the city of Jerusalem. And so here in verse 30, where it says, he shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant, these are the apostates, the Hellenists of Jewish culture and the Jerusalem leadership that embraced the demands of Antiochus. Now, those demands included, you're not going to worship Yahweh anymore. You're going to worship Zeus and the other gods that I demand that you worship. You're going to suspend all of the sacrifices of the temple. We're going to replace them with the sacrifices I want to be done. You know, there were many other things like that. It was at this point that he made it illegal to possess and study a copy of the Bible, the Torah. He made it illegal to be circumcised. He made it illegal to honor the Sabbath day. You know, all of the things that were essential to, you know, Jewish religion and life and culture. And, you know, in terms of making it illegal, it wasn't like a minor fine if anyone was caught doing any of these things. as we talked about before in our study in chapter 8, if you were caught with a scroll of the Torah, you were immediately executed. If you were caught circumcising someone, a child into the covenant, you were immediately executed. If you were caught keeping the Sabbath, you were immediately executed. And there were battles even, you know, as we'll talk about in just a moment, between the Jewish rebels against his efforts who lost their lives because they attempted to keep the Sabbath and refused to fight on the Sabbath during the battles that followed. And he took full advantage of that and would do his biggest strategies on the Sabbath day because he knew they wouldn't resist him and wouldn't fight him. So verse 31 goes on to say, "For forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate." This is his conquest of Jerusalem now, his conquest of the temple. He suspended the temple sacrifices. And this time he went further than the pig sacrifice before. This time he dedicated the entire temple to Zeus. He said, "This is now not the house of Yahweh, this is the house of Zeus." And this is where he erected the statue to Zeus and placed it in the Holy of Holies in place of the Ark of the Covenant. That's the statue that had his face on it. So he completely profaned the house of the Lord. This is the abomination of desolation. All right. Then in verse 32, "He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant." These are the heretics, or the ones that have left the true faith of the Lord, and who are Hellenists now and who are compromisers with Antiochus in following him, submitting to him. "He shall do so with flattery," meaning he made them many buttery promises that if you'll just follow me and you'll accept my demands, I'll make life so much easier for you. Things will be the way you want them to be. And they accepted his flatteries and his offers and violated the covenant of God. It says, "But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action." These people are, we've studied them before. I've even read a large section from the history of this time before. This is the Maccabean revolt. There was one priest. Jay gave us a message on Sunday about how one person can make such a difference if their heart is wholly given to following the Lord. One priest. The high priest was completely compromising and wicked. But one priest remained faithful. And he had three sons. And his three sons organized and led a rebellion, a revolt against Antiochus, the Maccabean revolt. The leader of them was Judas Maccabees. Judas Maccabeus. This is a good Judas, not a bad Judas. His name, Maccabee, was not his family name. It was a nickname given to him. The revolt was named after his nickname, and it meant the hammer. And the Lord used him to hammer, not just him individually, but the whole rebellion he led, used him to hammer over and over again, Antiochus. They used what we call guerrilla warfare. Didn't stand in open battle. He hit Antiochus where he wasn't expecting to be hit, when he wasn't expecting to be hit, how he wasn't prepared to be hit. And he hit him over and over and over and over again until eventually Antiochus became so fed up with being hit by the hammer that he just gave up. He said, "I'm done with this region of the world. I am leaving for good. I'm never coming back." And he left to go back to Syria, and a few months later he died mysteriously. But the description here is, it says, "He shall seduce with flattery those who were the compromisers, those who violate the covenant, but the people, the Maccabeans, the people who know their God, shall stand firm and take action." And that's exactly what they did. They stood in rebellion against this wicked king. They took action against him. And it says, "The wise among the people shall make many understand." These Maccabees, the reason that they were able to effectively organize the revolt is they simply did this. They held God's word out to God's people and said, this is what we live by. Not what this wicked king says. This is our standard. And they made many understand by returning their attention to the truth and the power of God's word. And it goes on to say, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame. Meaning the stumbling here isn't like compromised. Many of the Maccabees actually lost their lives in the rebellion, in the revolt. Some of them lost their lives in battle, that's by sword. Some of them were even burned alive. There's a likely reference to this at the end of the book of, or chapter 11 in Hebrews, where it talks about the heroes of the faith, some who were burned alive for their faithfulness to the Lord. There are some famous stories in the Maccabean revolt because Antiochus, being so wicked, you know, did things like, you know, he found a group of rebels hiding in a cave on the Sabbath day because they didn't want to fight on the Sabbath day, and he ordered them to just be roasted alive in the cave just because they wouldn't resist on that one day of the week. So they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help. What happened is, as, and this is a common pattern in God's dealings in history with through his people, when the people remain firm against this persecution, even though they were losing their lives, it raised sympathy among others that were observing how firm they stood and how they held to their convictions and risked their lives for the sake of truth and righteousness. And so many began to join the rebellion. And not only faithful ones that joined the rebellion, but it says, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. Some of the apostates that had left to follow Antiochus turned around and began to align themselves with the Maccabean rebels because they were concerned that the rebellion was going to win and then they would be the target of the anger of the Maccabees, because the Maccabees had threatened anyone. Once we drive this guy out, we're coming for all of those who have compromised with him. So they join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. This is just a twofold description for us in this last verse of the section. One is, why is all this happening? It's all happening for deeper, hidden, sanctifying purposes. God, whenever he pours out judgment and discipline upon his people, he doesn't do so just to make us hurt, just to cause pain. He does so to affect our hearts and to draw our hearts back to him. And while this is a horrendous time of trouble for the people of God, it was a purifying time. It's out of this time that a core of faithful people really truly, it was a revival time. They returned to the Lord with wholehearted zeal and desire. But at the same time, it's not yet the time of the end, where it still awaits the appointed time. The point of that is, as much as this rebellion, this Maccabean rebellion, resolved, it didn't resolve everything. There's still more to the story. And that more to the story is, all of this is leading up to the arrival of the Messiah into the world, because only he can resolve the problem that God's people continue to struggle with, of their hearts wandering away from him. So we'll stop there. And we'll pick up, the story's not over in chapter 11, we'll pick up in verse 36 in our study, Lord willing, next week. God bless.